This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of The Case of Nicolas Chauvin, a New York launch for the London-based White Review, featuring readings by Ned Bowman, Joshua Cohen, Jeremy M. Davies, and Diego Treyes Paz. The event was organized by the White Review and took place on February 10th, 2012.
Now we present an evening of Nicolas Chauvin, and our first reader is Josh Cohen.
Madame et Monsieur, thank you for coming this evening to celebrate me. Humble me, meek me, modest me, me. Nicolas Chauvin. Nicolas Joseph Lucien Louis Jerome Merovingia Carolingia Capet Voila Bourbon Louis XVI Chauvin. The Honorable, the Tolerable, the Third. Soldat, laborer, eponym, and grenadier. Though I'm a fusilier at heart and in the sack. Army de reserve, la grande armée, if you please. If you don't like my accent, admire my vocabulary. And if you don't like my vocabulary, feel free to admire my looks. This is how French sounds in outer space. I have been asked to come here, summoned from the starry halls of immortal posthumity, une petite Valhalla, to accept this award. Surely there's an award. But I will do more than consider accepting whatever crappy made in Taiwan tribute you offer. I will do much more, as I always do. Above and beyond, I will give you a speech. A speech and a toast with champagne from champagne. A weepy eulogy, melodramatic motivational seminar, art crit symposium, followed by a scrap of grand opera loosely based on a historical theme. This one's for the ladies. Lots of ladies out there tonight. Bitches, vicious grasping cunts, prepare. I will tell you about myself. I was born on the best day in the best year of the best country of the best earth. July 4th, 1776. My father was a large, slow man, a farmer with a lip problem, who in his younger years was something of a minor Celtic deity. Okay, he was a god. Okay, he was God. As for my mother, she was France. Marianne, that was her name. That liberty woman you always see. That girl naked under the tricolor cockade and Phrygian hat. Always with that rooster, either next to her or in her hands or kept under her skirts. A cockerel, a cock, if you know what I mean. Insatiable, my mother. The town, the village really, go humbler, go meeker, was called Rochefort on the Atlantic. It was the birthplace, too, of Admiral de Genouilly, who later on conquered Vietnam. It was a war I was too old to fight in, a war I told the press I was too old to fight in, only to allow others to have their own glory. A great naval town, which is why I chose to join the army. At age 6, though pretending 18. If Rochefort had been an army town, I'm sure I would have joined the Air Force. And as there wasn't any air force in the 18th and 19th centuries, I would have had to form one and invent the airplane. Probably not in that order. I was always doing the daring, the unexpected, the chauvinistic thing. Like, just now, you don't expect me to say Jew, pig, negro, vagina. My childhood was uneventful. It was spent shaving, pipe smoking, and hanging by the harbor among the floating prison colonies. During the Revolution, under the Jacobins, we kept 800 Roman Catholic priests out there on a fleet of jail ships for refusing to take an oath against the Pope. Most of them died. Starvation, dehydration, torture. That was my uneventful childhood. The shrieks of dying papists. A Wikipedia entry, which I wrote, claims that this was the world's first concentration camp. If I were running its tourist bureau, my modest birthplace would be putting that on postcards. I guess it's inevitable that Rochefort should have been chosen for me by destiny. Every hero begins with a flaw, an origin myth, or could have been chosen by him. Fuck him. Fuck that dwarf. To cast upon me and my posterity a tragic shadow. Just off the coast of Rochefort was where the 100 days ended. They were really 110 days, but that doesn't scan as charmingly. Just one inkling of the lies, the inky falsehoods of my general. This is difficult for me to talk about. Respect my difficulty or be destroyed. Above the HMS Bellerophon was where he who can go fuck himself surrendered. He was about to run off to America like a faggot with a pussy tucked between his legs. He should have fucking offed himself July 1815. By that time, I had fought on 8 continents. I am including France as a continent. I was old guard at Waterloo and the oldest and only guard at La Belle Alliance. I was fucking Cincinnatus. Alexander the greatest, but hey, no homo. I was the unknown soldier you just have to get to know. Still, they always want to type you, the historians, the scholar writers. They always want to patronize the patriot. I should get a better agent. I'm in the market for an agent. They say, no, Nick, you're fucking Alazon. You're just some 2-bit cameo appearance Miles Gloriosus. Hey, Il Capitano, Major Grognardo, I got your toy fencing sword right here. Right here. I am grabbing my nuts. I am grabbing my pistachios. They say, look, you take this honorary saber, 200 francs for your troubles. Go home to your peasanthood, retreat, retire, exploit your exploits, fabulate, fabricate, just like him, no better. Farm like your fallen godfather before you, some reasonable root vegetable. And be content slipping it to the local nurses, despite the fact that every time it rains, you get the aches. Count them, quote them, I've suffered. Quote, 17 wounds, all from the front, unquote. The front being the front lines, of course. I've been stabbed in the back, believe me. I had, quote, 3 fingers amputated. Suffered a shoulder fracture and a horribly disfiguring facial wound, unquote. According to Jacques Arago, defining my accursed eponym in his Dictionnaire de la Conversation, 1845, first time that cuss appeared. I'm not going to say it again. I say it every day. The proper part of it, anyway. The proprietary portion I should be charging. For my name, I could be raking fees. LaRousse mentioned me too, by the way. But then again, he also slandered the good Dr. Guillotine. And he also labeled Minister Jean Bigot, head of the Empire's religious affairs. You think a few 100 francs and a pansy red ribbon paid for all of this reconstructive surgery? Paid for, indeed, since the Maghreb slime so overtax our social services. You know how hard it is to mount women like light cavalry and beat them senseless with a fractured shoulder? That's posterity fodder, mes amis. Look, they had us backed against this wall at Waterloo. I don't mean figuratively. I mean the last goddamn wall of the last goddamn inn in all of the Netherlands, now Belgium. It was like a firing squad firing on another firing squad, but there was only one wall, and it was behind me, and I was in front of it. Some say I said something like, never surrender. Others say it was me or some guy named Pierre I never met before, and certainly I never saw him anywhere in Russia. Anyway, they said he was me or I was him, or we're composite characters, and we all said together, shit. Apparently some insufficiently murdered innkeeper's wife or daughter overheard it. So maybe we did say shit. Laugh all you want. I'd love to know what you'd say if I came at you with all the 7th Coalition. The Brits alone were enough for me alone, but Prussia, suck a duck dick. It takes a lot of man to take down Prussia. Now you'd say, wait, Nicholas, Joseph, Lucien, Louis, Jerome, Mervinga, Kaolinga, Capé, Vola, Bourbon, Louis XVI, Chauvin. You didn't take down Prussia. They won, you lost. Wellington and von Blücher ate your lunch. They drank it down with rape blood. Really? Is that what you think? Tell me about their immortalities. Wellington's famous for a beef stuffed in pastry. And Blücher? He designed a type of boot, I think. The ship the Nazis named after him was sunk. All officers are criminals, official criminals. I, however, have inspired great art. My bravery under fire, over fire, and even on fire has. My feats of daring do have, First Republic to Empire inclusive, La Cocarde Tricolore, not a vaudeville, a play, legitimate theater, 1831. Je suis Français, je suis Chauvin. The author's name, what was it? Pierre? At least his words are, let's be honest, just my name, my sad, unpacked, but like a pack you march with for uphill eternity and more name, will outlive any doggerel, any poems by Apollinaire, Baudelaire, Air, Verlaine, Rimbaud. Though Apollinaire sure enjoyed his First World War. Poor Jingo. I've been told I even inspired a novel. You might know it. War and Peace? By some Russian hippie scum? A teetotaling, non-smoking, veggie-fucking-tarian. I've not read any of it, but I know what I think of it, or what to think of it anyway. I find it odd that this novel is based on me, but that in it, I'm not only not French, but Russian. And actually two Russians, as if one true Frenchman can only be defamed by two Russian spies, codenames Bostov and Rolkonsky. That book apparently celebrates... All right, okay. I will utter that ass-fuck appellation. Napoleon. Napoleon Boner Party. I'll even give a little Napoleon that fait acute, that diacritic mark atop the E. My gay lords and ladies, he deserves to be remembered correctly, that Corsican Arab, that greaseball Moor. Warts and Penis portrays him as fat and farty and short, and he was definitely short and highly ineffective. If he wasn't a technical midget, he sure had midget blood in him. But still, the book tries to show his greatness, his genius, a fine imagination he had, that hippie mafioso Lev Trotsky. He and Napoleon had the same complex. I will say something now about names. People use my name, not properly, not as a proper name, but as a regular word. They bend my capital, they bow my knee, they guillotine me minuscule, the nerve. Oh, how hard they will be doomed to suck it. But though I can be demoted, re-ranked, I will not be misunderstood. None of us will be. Historians have always said that I hetero-loved Napoleon and would have fought for him to the end. I would have done anything for the guy. Cooked last omelets, taken care to pick up his shrouds from the dry cleaners. But the truth is, I hated the prick. History boy, troop reviewer, I fought for France. The France in my pants. His hand was always in his shirt, milking that supernumerary nipple. It's unconscionable that now in death, my name's been resurrected as some breed of blind and deaf pet. A devotee, a follower, some abuser of the undeserving. But there is no undeserving. We are all deserving. About the following allegations. I only served what I believed in. Napoleon only believed in himself. Whereas I believed in fishy whores with massive pots of mayonnaise between their legs where I could dip my French fry. I believed in them to my dying day, July 12th, 1906, the day they pardoned Dreyfus. 8 days after my 130th birthday. My French fry was still as rigid ridged as ever. About the abuse, then. I only hate the haters. Let the record show that I've only ever hated the haters. Chauvinist may, there, I've said it. To preserve what one believes in, yes, I'll accept this definition. To protect one's values, rights, land, life, and freedom from Algerians, that is me, that is us. There can be no other synonym. But to use words or violence only to protect the self, to aggrandize the self, the individual, that must be called Napoleonisme. That should be called Napoleonism. Could I get a seat on the French Academy for this? Can I get a seat? We, as a continent, should remember this. You, each and every citizen, should ask yourself the toughies. If you want the Negroes out of Paris, is it because you can't stand their shiny muscles? Or is it because their shiny muscles are anathema to France? The chinks or nips or Indopox might have taken your job, but we must not set our foreign legions or nuclear arsenals against them unless or until they've also deprived us of our cultural identity, of the dignity or nobility of a hegemony to call our own. Because this was always our power. Le capital culturel and its colonies, our comfing toward a culture. Take my money and take my property, but never cease to pay lip service for even a breath to the Eurosport channel and the ouvre of Depardieu. To have a culture is to be a chauvinist. Rather, the culture is Chauvin. We are one and we must be one. Remember, no one remembers the other three Napoleons. In closing, I accept this prize on our behalf. Don't forget to validate your parking. Le Pen 2012 and Death to Algeria. Let's stay in touch at nc@chauvin.com. .fr was taken. And now is Jeremy Davies.
Hello. So I was going to start out by saying this is more of a confession than a lecture, but I think the stage has been set for that. When a night dedicated, can you hear me? Is it good? When a night dedicated to Chauvin was proposed, my first thought, or the first thought I'd like to share, was of a statistical analysis of the English language carried out recently at the University of Vermont. And this is true. It was fresh in my mind, having just lit up a few websites on its way to the place of dead links. Apparently, the study had concluded that language itself is coded to be positive, biased toward talking the world and its speakers up. So, I should say right off that I do most of my thinking surrounded by books, by people making books, people discussing and selling and designing and tweaking and schlepping books from here to there, filling boxes with them and shipping them to other rooms filled with books, people being anxious, moreover, about books, people who lose sleep over books. So where this one ill-understood point led in my thinking raised Chauvin, and in the context of being invited to speak on account of the White Review, was to literature, or more precisely, nationalist literature, by which I mean work that extols the superiority of one nation or people over another, or the superiority of its beliefs, racial characteristics, songs, drinks, soups, and so forth. Publicity, the inclusion or exclusion of given values, a given reading of a national history, reassurance often when a culture or stratum of that culture is under threat. The national epic that succeeds at being both propaganda and art. Now, there would have been a time in my life when I'd have said that there's no such animal, that any agenda in a work of literature save the aspiration to literature itself, and more on this later, would poison it. But if language itself, no matter what use it might be put to, must necessarily promote its subject, then even works intended as criticism, satire, outright vitriol, are working at all times for the enemy. And I'll define the enemy rather broadly as the body politic circumscribing all of our efforts at communication, in which our words and thoughts originated, and which we all suspect, and I think everyone probably feels this way, has never had our best interests at heart. And this is a personal example from my life. My maternal grandparents are Austrian. They emigrated to the United States in 1938. They almost didn't make it. Most of the family, indeed, did not make it. Small wonder, then, that I grew up both ignorant and disinterested when it came to my so-called national heritage as an Austrian or second-generation American. This lasted about until I was 14 or 15 in my first year at my first secular school when I discovered a book called, in English, Gargoyles by Thomas Bernhard. Bear in mind, I probably mistook it for something about actual gargoyles at the time. This was in a Barnes & Noble in Rockland County, and pre-internet, when it would have been nearly impossible for me to ferret out anyone who could have told me what precisely I was getting into by buying this book, or indeed that I was not the only person who had gotten into it. So that became my Austria, which is to say a place and nation for which my jolly tour guide had developed a compulsive loathing, a place that I could have told you nothing about, yet a place that I now thought fondly of, despite Bernhard's hatred of it, because did I not remember his hilarious hatred of it and what fun we'd had together. In 1997, I directed Bernhard's play Ritter Dene Voss at my cozy little liberal arts college in New England, and my grandmother, bless her, wanted to know what her peculiar grandson was up to. So I sent her the text. This is the translation by Peter Jansen and Kenneth Northcott. And she replied in an email. Steinhoff, she reminisced, which is the name of the mental hospital from which the main character, based on Paul Wittgenstein, has just been released. That's the insane asylum they used as a holding pen before shipping us to the camps. And there was I staring at the space thinking, oh, the cafes of Vienna. So in my original thinking about this lecture, where all this would have led me inevitably, would be a toward a rhapsody on behalf of some impossible negation of language's incessant positivity, how to combat the yes of semiotic chauvinism with the no of no coherent or constructive program. The no that reminds us that our objective must always be anything but what is achievable per the terms of this argument that we've inherited. So, the ways in which reading even an excoriation of a place, reading even about a place that is horrifying and in prose that is, as they say, exquisite, makes that place familiar, pleasant, something of a second home. Or I should say makes the sentences we inhale pleasant, familiar, something of a second home. So Bernhardt and Austria, Bulgakov and Stalinist Russia, or Gogol or Belly for Tsarist Russia, or you can name your favorites. Literature, even subversive literature, must end up eulogizing its targets, be they national or more evanescent. And the better the work, the better the memory of reading, and the better the propaganda. We can curl up even with atrocities and find the experience comforting. So this line of reasoning borders some dangerous territory. You can pick your poison. There's the A, traditional forms of literary prose must all be thrown to the knacker's yard in favor of whatever model of disjunctive or aleatoric writing turns you on right now. Or B, at the other end of the spectrum, we must only write about nice or praiseworthy things so as not to leave people astray. And that would have been well and good and appropriate for this evening, because I could hear Chauvin going down either of those roads and believing it and, you know, putting people to the sword for not believing it. But I then came to the conclusion that I was missing the real story, because my idea of Austria and how I obtained it are not only indicative of my experience of reading, but emblematic of my means of interacting with pretty much all of life, which is to say by way of books. Not only Austria, but every country on my subjective map only bloomed in that bog because a book had planted it there. The globe in my head would resemble one of those grotesque sensory homunculi with its parts drawn larger or smaller depending on the amount of real estate the regulation takes up in the brain. I don't know if any of you have seen it. It's all hands and lips and genitals. So there would be a monstrous France, a bloated Germany and Britain, a decent Russia that nonetheless drops into the sea half a continent early, a sliver of India and Japan. Australia would be a short walk south across a land bridge since there's no China or Southeast Asia. The U.S., of course, like cancer, cradling everything in its pincers. There's a reason why writing of whatever stripe, positive or negative, radically paratactical or draped in Jamesian ermine, glorifies its subjects, because it can only really glorify itself. This sort of nationalism has nothing to do with the phenomenal world, nothing to do with nations, and everything to do with the Republic of Letters, to which I have apparently pledged my allegiance. So, here I am. I am the object of my lesson, lecture, an object lesson. For literature, I made damn sure all through my school years that I learned not a single thing of value, that I refrain from approaching any project with rigor. I have so internalized literature's call to eliminate the received, the cliché, that I am unable to issue the correct stock responses, even when these are called for, and justified by context. Tell me someone in your family has died, I'm more likely to say, oh, than I'm sorry. Tell me you love me, and I'm likely to laugh. I can offer no condolence, I entrust no confidence. I do not call people on the phone because I know I don't have the words. The words to describe those absent words, yes, I've got those in abundance, and I will sell them very cheap if you want to see me after the show. For literature, I got into a brawl once with a cousin, once removed, after trying for a half hour to explain to him why I didn't consider Donald Trump a real writer. This was during a wedding. It wouldn't be too much to say that sex put down roots in my head in the same manner as Austria. It wouldn't be too much to say that my body has been altered by literature, by reading and writing, perhaps to excess, made photophobic, unhealthy, made stooped, volute. My reasoning and rhetoric likewise. I've always taken it for granted that the world is loathsome and the word is not. I have praised purple prose, and you'll have noticed that even while trying to be straightforward, I can't cut all the curlicues from my diction. Ask me to sincere, and I will answer that sincerity is a rhetorical mode. For literature, I moved to Illinois. I can't even have the satisfaction of saying that literature has ruined me, for I've never had a life wider than the radius of that ruination. Literature is, above all, propaganda for literature. Chauvin is ridiculous for his blind and excessive patriotism being unassailable. No facts, no arguments, nor even his own mutilation, says the legend, could sway it. I've known my share of people adhering to powerful, often lunatic, religious principles. There comes a point, an event horizon, where all the words one has spoken in support of a belief become, in aggregate, a single noun that squats right on top of your personal pronoun, hungry to be modified by whatever the world puts in your way. Nothing can overturn this conviction because everything that one encounters just nourishes the parasite. Me, I spend my time sitting out of the sun and staring at the work of venal men and women, and the venal men and women emulating those venal men and women, because I go on believing that despite the much remarked corruption and blindness of the industry and the culture in which they, we, I live, and on whose behalf they make themselves unfit for much else, and despite my own exhaustion, prejudice, and resentment, and despite the fact that our own language betrays us at every syllable, nonetheless, through the many chambers of this meat grinder, there may emerge a new telegram from the fatherland. I need not level accusations against the mother tongue, against nations, or even finally against literary life, whatever that may be, to address Chauvin's relevance, because he's right here. I don't need to go looking for him. Thank you. And I welcome Ned Bowman to the podium.
Hi. So this will only be funny if you've been on the website okcupid.com, which statistically all of you have, although possibly not even funny then. So the usage of chauvinism, which I think strays the furthest from the mutilated corpse of Chauvin himself, is carbon chauvinism, which was first used by famous science druid Carl Sagan in the 1970s. And you are a carbon chauvinist if you think that intelligent life in the universe is guaranteed to be based on carbon, like we are, instead of silicon or nitrogen or iron or candy floss or whatever else might be out there. And there are all sorts of other exobiological chauvinisms, exobiological meaning to do with the biology of alien races. So you can be a water or an oxygen chauvinist if you think that those races will need water or oxygen. You can be a planetary chauvinist if you think that an alien race will necessarily start on a planet that's orbiting a sun. You can even be a chemical or a molecular chauvinist if you think that an alien race will have to be made out of molecules and chemical processes, which everyone does pretty much. But like, you can never be quite sure. They could be made out of neutrinos or like brain waves or just guilt or whatever is out there. So that too is a form of chauvinism. And in fact, Sagan quotes this, the great French astronomer Laplace, who was the first person to point out that if conditions on other planets are so different from conditions on Earth, then necessarily the products of those planets, as he put it, will be very different as well. So he was a contemporary of Chauvin, and he, like Chauvin, he met Napoleon, and he was the first person to point out that maybe we should start abandoning some of these chauvinisms about alien races. The reason why carbon chauvinism and the like, I think, feels a bit strange is that normally chauvinisms are predicated on the sort of conspicuous and irritating presence of the thing you're being a chauvinist about. So, like, there's no Chauvin without the British and the Prussians. You can't be a racist if there are no other races. You can't be a sexist if there are no broads. But as far as we know, there are no aliens. So how can you be a chauvinist about something that may not even exist? And I was thinking about this recently when I was watching that Shit New Yorkers Say video, which, again, statistically, all of you have seen. And in that, where they're like, who goes to the Empire State Building? Who goes to the Statue of Liberty? Because I've only lived in New York for 5 months, and I already find it impossible to conceive of a human being who would go to the Statue of Liberty, even though I have been to the Statue of Liberty. And I think what that video shows us is that, you know, New York is a wonderful but very narcissistic city, and New Yorkers often have trouble conceiving of other, like, non-New York ways of living. And that is, I think, intuitively, that sort of falls into the category of chauvinism. And in just the same way, we live on a wonderful but very narcissistic planet. And Earthlings, again, have trouble imagining other forms of life. So that is a chauvinism too, or carbon chauvinism and so on. But the next question is, like, what is the problem with carbon chauvinism? Because, as we've said, like, there may not be any aliens. There's no brigade of Martians holding signs saying, like, a sentient race needs long chain hydrocarbons like a fish needs a bicycle. Or I suppose like a space fish needs a space bicycle. Like, there's no one to offend or discriminate against with these chauvinisms. And the answer is to do with SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which, as we all know from the X-Files, is where you you point a giant satellite in the jungle at into space to listen for radio waves from other civilizations. And if we adopt all these chauvinisms and we think that alien races probably are based on something like carbon, they live on planets, they're made of molecules, all of that, then that makes sense, that approach. But if we think they could just be like living on asteroids and made out of eggnog, then we have to broaden our approach for looking for them, perhaps even into sort of in abstract terms that we can't even imagine yet. Relatedly, chauvinism have a big effect on the Fermi paradox, which is also known as the Great Silence, which is this thing that physicist Enrico Fermi was the first person to really articulate, which is, if there are alien races out there, why haven't we heard from them yet? And there's three main explanations that people offer. One is, actually, there aren't any alien races out there. We really are alone in the universe. The second is, there are alien races, but for some reason, communication hasn't been established. And the third is, there have been alien races, but they have destroyed themselves before they've got to the point of communicating with us. And that's called the doomsday hypothesis. And that was actually what Sagan thought most likely himself, because he was, you know, growing up during the Cuban Missile Crisis and so on. And he thought that, you know, that's what happens. I find that especially poignant that the doomsday hypothesis is so popular, because SETI always sort of feels a bit like being single in New York, in the sense that, you know, you've been alone for a long time, you really just want to meet like a nice race that you can hang out with, but it's not really happening. And in the same way, the doomsday hypothesis is like, I don't know about you, but if I'm ever on a first date and the other person doesn't turn up, my first thought is always, she's dead. It's never like, oh, she changed her mind, because that would be depressing. It's never even, she got the time wrong. It's, she's dead, she's not here, she must be dead. She probably got run down by one of those Chinese delivery guys on a bike. Probably the gutters of Avenue Way are awash with arterial fluid and hoisin sauce, even more than usual. And the doomsday hypothesis is much the same. It's like saying, well, they're not here, but that's because they wanted to come, but they just couldn't, because they destroy themselves in like a fiery holocaust before they could make it happen, which is comforting in a way, I guess, but it's sort of also discomforting because the doomsday hypothesis entails not just that there was some alien race that destroyed itself, it entails that every alien race that could have contacted us destroyed itself first, which implies that there's something inherent in the nature of like a globe-spanning civilization that eventually commits a sort of species suicide, which obviously has big implications for any planet, including ours. Because, you know, it's nearly happened to us in the past. It could happen in this century. So if possible, we want to avoid that hypothesis because it's super depressing. And this is where the chauvinisms come back in. Because, remember, there are two other explanations. One is that there simply are no other alien races. And if we abandon the exobiological chauvinisms, then that explanation recedes into the background. Because if you think about it, if a race doesn't have to be made out of carbon and molecules and on a planet, if it can be made out of anything and live anywhere, if the conditions for developing intelligence are so much wider and more tolerant, then it begins to seem even less likely that there really isn't anyone else out there. It begins to seem almost impossible. So that kind of cuts out that hypothesis, which is troubling because that makes the doomsday hypothesis even more prominent. But remember, there is also a third hypothesis, which is that there are other intelligent races out there. They just, for some reason, haven't established communication. And if we abandon the exobiological chauvinisms, then it makes that hypothesis look very good. Because if these putative alien races don't look anything like us, if they're even in conceptual terms, they're nothing like us, if they really are made out of like neutrinos and like live in an Oort cloud or whatever, then of course we haven't heard from them, because the gulf between us and them is so great. Like, the conceptual middle ground that we would even have between our intelligence and their intelligence is so tiny or even non-existent that communication might not be possible. Which is a bit like, you know, there's that self-help book, Why Are All the Good Ones Gay? Because it's a bit like saying there are eligible alien races out there, and again, they would be totally into us. It's just we're not really on the same wavelength, so that's why nothing's happened yet. So if we abandon the exobiological chauvinisms, then we can comfort ourselves with the thought that civilizations don't necessarily commit suicide. The reason we haven't heard from them is because they don't look anything like us, so they can't talk to us. Unfortunately, there is a fourth hypothesis, which I haven't mentioned yet, which is even darker than the doomsday hypothesis, which is what if the reason we haven't heard from alien races is that they have existed, and it's not that they destroyed themselves, it's that they destroyed each other, and that's why we haven't heard from them yet. And that is the only scenario in which we really will have to be learn to be tactful about carbon chauvinism and so on, in the same way that we've already learned to be tactful about like gender chauvinism and race chauvinism. Because if they come here and they're armed and we say the wrong thing, then the question we'll be asking ourselves is like, who destroys the Statue of Liberty? Who destroys the Empire State Building? Who does that? And as the death rays rain down around us, then it won't really matter whether they're made of carbon or silicon or anything else, because we'll all be vaporized. So our next speaker is Diego.
I'm the only Latino here. It's kind of obvious. I'm not used to this, so I'm gonna do my best. I'm Diego Treyes Paz, and I'm from Peru. First of all, I want to thank Joshua Boschner and all the people from Cabinet Magazine. I'm probably here thanks to my friend Jax Testa, one of the editors of the White Review. The White Review is an amazing London-based art and culture magazine that I also like to thank. One of my short stories was published on their second issue. It was translated by Janet Hendrickson, who is also the translator of that book, The Future Is Not Ours, an anthology of young Latin American writers that I edited in 2008. Open Letter Books will release it this summer here in the United States. Why is that important? Because in the American literature market, you only translated 5% of all your books. So basically, you don't read us. So this is the auto-promotional part of my talk, and I'm not gonna apologize for it. I don't really know where else I can promote South American writers that are not Bolaño in the city. I normally warn people about my accent when reading, but I'm not going to do it this time, because now it's kind of cool. Thanks to people like Sofia Vergara, speaking English this way has become really popular and exotic and suave or suave, okay? What I'm doing right now is just telling to change the. I'm not like nervous. You're gonna be watching me doing that thing. Okay, so Chauvin. More than a lecturer of Chauvin, the semi-medical French soldier who, despite poverty and the disfiguring injuries he suffered, was blindly devoted to Napoleon, I would like to throw some ideas related to chauvinism, which take his name after him. I'm not really interested in getting the story straight about this mad Napoleonic hero, but in the implications and the salt legacy of his name. My idea is to think about chauvinism and its current pernicious influence in my country, in Peru, a developing Latin American country with a market-oriented economy. I will do it in a very playful way, or that's what I'm gonna try. Therefore, the text I'm going to read is neither an academic paper nor a work of fiction, and it starts with me in Peru. 2 weeks ago, I was enjoying my summer in Lima. Peru, my homeland, seemed to be the best place to spend my vacation. Lima was at 30 degrees Celsius, which is like 86 degrees Fahrenheit. There were big waves to surf, cold beer and ceviche, soccer on the beach, and tons of dudes and ladies from all around the world enjoying free love and cheap drugs. People in the street looked happy and felt very proud of those wonderful things international credit rating agencies were saying about our country. They called us, quote, one of the world's fastest growing economies. They called us the place, quote, with the lowest financing needs in Latin America for 2012. They called us a responsible nation that stands out for, quote, its superb economic performances. They called us all of that and more, and we were sincerely flattered. They even promised to, quote, upgrade our credit rating from BBB minus to BBB. Pamal. For a country whose economy dramatically collapsed in 1998 with a hyperinflation above 1,000%, a nation that was defined by the Chicago Tribune as, quote, the basket case of South America facing its world depression of the century, a place in which economic distress and social inequality has strengthened the shining path. A revolutionary guerrilla endorsing Maoism that, together with the Peruvian military, would kill around 60,000 people. The praise of these faceless bankers and anonymous financial entities that rule the world were a tremendous boon to our ego. So there I was in my homeland, enjoying the fruits of our economic boom, eating like a king, thanks to the magical flavors of Peruvian cuisine, and drinking pisco sour, a national unique cocktail made of pisco, lemon juice, egg whites, simple syrup, and bitters that I drank in excess. Was I happy as most of my fellow citizens for Peruvian national progress? Yes and no. But I won't explain the latter right now. Let's say I was just enjoying my summer in Lima. Nicolás Chauvin did not really exist in my life. But then one day, I got Joshua Buckner's email and everything changed. Chauvin. In its original meaning, chauvinism has been defined as, quote, conspicuous, excessive, or otherwise weird identification with one's own group, with hostility towards other groups. And also as, quote, an exaggerated bellicose patriotism and belief in national superiority and glory. The story of how this word became an eponym, of a presumably apocryphal French soldier named Nicolas Chauvin is a very well-known story. And at this point in the evening, well, I thought you were talking about that story, so I'm pretty sure that we have heard about it enough, so I won't get further into it. And I won't. What really amazes me about Chauvin is the way in which this devoted and loyal man, who bravely believed and followed a common cause until the end, turned first into the laughingstock of Napoleon's army, and then, until this day, into a symbol of such a dreadful and harmful concept. Who was really Chauvin, if he even existed? What is about his story that came to embody such extreme and hostile views? How did his name become synonymous with bigotry and sexism, and himself a detestable symbol to the women's liberation movement? What is about his story that came to embody such, how did his name become, what was he, the war hero that, quote, sustained 17 war wounds, lost fingers, had his face disfigured, and still kept up his rara attitude out of his excessive nationalistic fervor? Or was he a despot wingnut with an unreasonable superiority complex about their own social group? Was he real? Does it really matter? If the whole story was apocryphal and he was not a real person, just an entelechy created by a brilliant and funny playwriter, if Chauvin is nothing but pure literature that ended completely wrong, what elements of his story do Peruvians seem to share and unconsciously reproduce in these times of prosperity and national progress? Peru. The first time I noticed that economic success was turning even my own friends into huge fans of our country, I mean, vacuous, chauvinist, superficial narcissists in love with the idea of becoming the new Latin American metropolis, was when I saw this viral ad, wait, on Facebook. You're gonna love this ad, but I'm gonna show only like 3 or 4 minutes. Then you can watch it on Facebook, okay? Oh, YouTube.
Todo peruano, por el solo hecho de ser peruano, tiene derecho a gozar de lo maravilloso que es ser peruano. Perú, Nebraska. 569 habitantes, un grifo, un restaurante, una avenida, un banco, un museo, una estación de tren que, bueno, ahora sirve para otros fines, su escuela, su tanque de agua, su alcaldía y un sheriff cuyo último trabajo fue separar a un perro de un gato en 1998. Perú, Nebraska, tiene un problema. Son peruanos, pero no saben qué significa serlo.
Muchachos, llegamos. Vamos, vamos, Cristian. Vamos, dale.
Probando, probando.
Oye, ¿y dónde hemos llegado?
Nuestra misión, ser embajadores de nuestro país y leerles sus derechos como peruanos.
Ustedes son de Perú. Tienen derecho a comer rico. Les repito, ustedes son de Perú. Anticucho, ceviche, papa rellena.
¿Quieren probar? You can try it.
What do you call this?
Chicha
morada.
Huancaína.
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 Ya.
Yuca.
Yuca.
Aceituna.
Chuno.
Aceituna.
What is that?
That's ocopa.
Ocopa.
You want to know a secret?
A secret?
I don't eat fish.
¿Te gusta? Do you like it?
It tastes like bubblegum.
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 Yeah, I know. It's like 15 minutes. Come on. This thing is... Okay. I must admit this is a pretty cool video. Everybody was so proud of being Peruvian. Everybody felt that this publicity was selling properly and fairly the essence of our culture. The idea of telling the inhabitants of a lost American town, we'll talk about American word later, that they were also Peruvians, and therefore that they also have the right to eat yummy food, was a very creative way to sell our gastronomy to the world. However, it made me think about the 60% of the population, the Peruvian population, that survive by the day and can't really afford to eat well. It made me think about that huge part of Peruvians that are not allowed to participate of this excluding prosperity. What does Chauvin have to do with them? Well, the most peculiar thing about this popular ad was that most of the poor people happened to be really happy and proud about the ad. They felt represented and included. They basically were more than happy than us. I mean us, because I'm not poor, I am from the middle class. However, and this part is I'm gonna improvise. Funny thing happened just recently. A writer said that he didn't like Peruvian food, and he's from Peru. And people wanted to kill him. People really want to kill him just because he expresses his opinion. And until today, before I left my friend's house, they were trying to kill him. So I think what I'm trying to say here is that I'm not against the idea of economic prosperity, but in my country there's still a huge gap between rich people and poor people, and there's a whole idea of Peru as a brand doesn't really talk about what's really happening over there. Although I'm happy we don't have the hyperinflation, so that's it. Well, it's not it. Since we are talking about chauvinism here, I'm gonna be a chauvinist for a little while. And there's a mention to Shining Path. I don't know if you know about Shining Path or what they did to my country. But I brought this other very, very small piece that talks about that epoch in which I live in Peru, and we were in this horrendous civil war. The name of this piece is Panic. When I was a kid, I pretended to be a DJ. I used a black microphone, long and skinny like a mourning finger. One of those Philips audio double-deck stereos with Dolby sound system. It was a useless piece of shit, flawed equipment with a broken antenna that I had mended with masking tape. The rec button was completely tied after running so many pirate mixes. The small rear battery compartment didn't have the lead and had taken a life of its own by flying the batteries out, right in the middle of those interday Shining Paths blackouts that brought candles and dull neighbors to my kitchen. I don't know if I was talented enough to mix music. I probably wasn't, because I would imitate any of those Peruvian radio DJs that talk in an affected voice. The only thing that these poor foolish men knew was to say, chévere suavecito, which is like cool. And then without any remorse to play a song by The Cure, back to back with one of Yuri or Magneto, Justin Bieber, who were very chéveres and suavecitos back then. It didn't matter. I pretend I was a DJ. My tapes were arranged in perfect order. After playing decent music, I used to chat with my imaginary audience and I don't remember being unhappy, but quite the opposite. One day, heavy metal came into my life, and I decided to become a headbanger. Since I was a metal DJ, I let my hair grow out and started to frequent the black music markets of Colmena Avenue to buy cassettes with covers full of demons and upside-down crosses. I love imitating a popular radio show from Peru called Star Wars, in which rock and roll bands fought between each other for the listener's attention. I was a huge Metallica fan, and for me, it was pretty logical to bring Metallica face to face with any shitty metal band made up of loud singing God haters. My fictional audience will call to vote, and I will make it hard for Metallica until Triumphant and Full Blooded, thanks to Wong, a song from the album And Justice for All that I danced to banging my head in circles. The four Metallica band members emerged victorious from any challenge I put before them. Certain day, I realized that Metallica gave me a headache and that I didn't give a fuck about its music no more. I cropped my hair very close, almost shaven. I made them lose the Star Wars contest to everyone, even to Michael Bolton, but I didn't stop broadcasting. I was already a teenager, still playing at being a DJ, but that second act wouldn't last long. The day when CDs arrived, they turned my collection of pirate cassettes comical and obsolete, and my loyal Philips Audio double-deck stereo with Dolby sound system decided to commit suicide because of something related to technological pride. It was over. My DJing marathons ended. I remember my last broadcast in vivid detail because my listeners called to show their support and to wish me a happy and blissful life. Just to fuck with them so that they wouldn't think that I was going to go around in life feeling moved by such stupid bullshit. My last words before I turned off the mic were chévere and suavecito. It's a commonplace to us writers at what point they made the conscious decision to dedicate their lives to literature. When I am asked that question, I usually lie and say foolishness that later on I regret. Today, however, I remember that when I was a kid, I pretended to be a DJ. I also realized that one could create stories with a pencil or a computer or a typewriter or a camera or music or mind, and that being a DJ, perhaps without suspecting it, I had already invented and lied and substituted this idiotic, ugly world for one that was entirely of my own. In this brief fragment, where an involuntary declaration of principles, it would only be missing a proper soundtrack. I feel a little awkward attempting a set in New York before the screen of this Mac that has no buttons, batteries, or a life of its own. Outside, it's snowing, and the knuckles of wind are knocking on the window panes of my room. Now, the only blackouts in my life are those brought on by ice storms. I don't have a microphone or earmuffs, but I know that my audience will start calling at any moment. Panic on the streets of London sang Morrissey when the Smiths were the most important band on the planet, and I'm only waiting that part of the song when he demands the DJ to be hanged. Burn down the disco and the blessed DJ, because the music that they constantly play, it says nothing to me about my life. Deceit, fiction, images, music, pain and laughter, the relentless passage of time. In this magical verse of panic, I find everything that I have tried to explain to myself tonight before I turn my computer off, bring my imaginary radio show to a close, bid farewell to my listeners, and leave the airwaves forever. Gracias.
Thank you.